Hate to interrupt your meal again. You're having so much fun, such great camaraderie, but we do have a program. So if I could have your attention, I will introduce the person who's going to introduce our speaker today. As all of our members know, we get all these great speakers that come because of a personal relationship between one of our members or somebody on the wait list. If you're on the wait list and you want to become a member, just bring in a speaker. So this personal relationship is what's so important. And the person who's going to introduce the speaker has worked in the Reagan White House. She was the highest ranking female in the Reagan White House at that time. And she used that experience for a couple of things. Number one, she made these great contacts and can bring in great speakers for us. But number two, she used all that experience to write three best-selling thriller novels. Here's one of them. And this last one has just come out in paperback in case you want to get a copy. So let me introduce our speaker, our past director, Connor Bodman. Connor.
Thank you, Wade. I am delighted to introduce our speaker today. Margaret Spellings has had a distinguished career, not only in the field of education, but she's also developed policies for housing, transportation, labor, and justice. But it's her No Child Left Behind initiative that really gained the most prominence. I know you all have heard about that. And how prominent? Well, it was discussed not only in Congress and in all of the media for years, but I want you to know that Margaret is the only cabinet member of any administration that I can think of who has had, you might say, the nerve to appear on two late-night comedy shows to sell her plan. Now, on the Jon Stewart, I've seen the clips. On the Jon Stewart show, when she showed up on the set, he gave her an apple, a bunch of number two pencils, and a Lunchable. Okay, so that was sort of cute. Then on the Colbert Report, the host tried to kind of get cute when he introduced her, you know, and said, all that education and she's still a secretary, you know, sort of funny. But in the interview, Margaret truly had the last word. When discussing her policy, he asked, so, what happens to the children who are left behind? And without missing a beat, she replied, they become television personalities. So, please welcome Margaret Spellings. Thank you, Karna.
And that's a true story. You forgot Jeopardy and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which were also fun and maybe a whole lot stupid. I came in second in Jeopardy, but I was on with somebody who'd been on there before, and I bet there are a few Jeopardy fans in here. Thank you for that. I guess I would say, I hope to be able to say warm welcome, Karna. Karna lured me down here because everybody wants to come to Naples in January, right? Except when it's freezing. And thank you, Wade, for your leadership of this organization and all you do. Karna and I met through my friend and fellow cabinet member, Sam Bodman, who is the Secretary of Education. And you know Karna, who is a prolific author and has plenty of stories to tell. And I could tell right away when we got connected that we were going to get along just fine. So she's all these Bodmans are my favorite people around. And speaking of my favorite people, I want you to meet my daughter, Mary LaMontagne, that is accompanying me today. She just graduated from Davidson College in May, and she is employed. Every parent's dream. She's off my payroll and on Bank of America's. And I'm glad that she accompanied me today. And I'm really thrilled to be here myself. It's an honor to be included in the phenomenal group of speakers that you all are able to draw here and those that you've hosted over the past 25 years. And I appreciate not only your invitation, but your commitment and your interest to education. I know it inspires your work, certainly as evidenced by the scholarship programs, by your support for the students that are here from St. John Newman and Gulf Coast High School. I want to thank you for all of that. And Natalie, listen, if you have learned, where are you, Natalie? If you've learned how to listen and be careful, we need to get you to Washington right away. There are some people who need to learn that up there. So thank you for your commitment to education. I know you all know that it is key and critical to everyone's success, and it is a mission that I feel quite passionately about and had the honor and the privilege of advancing as the United States Secretary of Education for 4 years, and I've been involved in education policy for about 2 decades before that. I know you can't believe it with this very young face that I have, but it's true. I've been involved since the 80s. Texas was a pioneer in education reform, and lots of states, especially like Florida, followed suit in doing some things that made our schools more accountable and more interested and focused on student achievement. And I'm proud to say that you all in Florida could teach folks around the rest of the country a lot about how to do that. And Dennis, your superintendent, and I were talking about that. He's had the chance to serve in Tennessee and Illinois and here. And I think, you know, there really are some real state differences. State policy matters a lot. Education is a strong passion for me because, like all of us, like all Americans, we see the impact of education really everywhere, from our economy to healthcare, and especially to our competitiveness as a nation. You know that. It seems obvious. It seems trite, but it really is true. Our country's future, it's really not overstated to say that it will depend on how well we prepare our young people to be innovators and workers and leaders of tomorrow, to seize the opportunities of science and technology and aerospace and healthcare, the things that you all are pursuing, to create the new industries that will solve our challenges before us in energy, in improving our environment, and in alleviating poverty, and in creating jobs. And, of course, education is profoundly important in all of our lives. We know that. What we aspire for our children, for our grandchildren, and for ourselves is a lifetime of learning. We know it's the difference between building a career and building a future and a family, and the difference between fulfilling something a less fulfilling life. The key difference is education. We see it in our own lives. The consequences are huge, so we've got to get it right. And frankly, right now, we've got a long ways to go. So I'd like to share a few thoughts with you today about the progress we've made and what we still need to do. I also want to urge you to be involved, to continue to stay involved, not only as an organization, but as individuals, to get energized, to hold ourselves accountable, to hold our schools accountable, because the only way we're going to be successful if we have more focus, more urgency, more intensity about what's at stake here. And frankly, I think we really have lacked the urgency to really attend to what we know needs to be done. So I'm going to start my discussion with a little lesson on where we are in elementary and secondary education, starting with some history. When President Bush came to office in 2001, the federal government was spending tens of billions of dollars, as we continue to do, on education, and really seen very little for its money. It's what I call the send the money out, hope for the best approach. The Federal Department of Education had always been focused on our nation's most disadvantaged students, our neediest students, and we basically had a good intentions, no accountability kind of approach. In short, students were falling way short on international tests. Levels of proficiency were declining. We literally had 28 years of flatline achievement, especially with poor and minority students. And the achievement gap, that difference between advantaged students and poor and minority students, was huge and growing. And it wasn't really the fault of any one person or any politician or one party. It really was the fault of a flawed mindset and, frankly, a lot of neglect. And it said that our mindset was, if we spend more, we'll get more. And that just wasn't right. So when President Bush came to office, he knew that we had to start insisting on better results, especially for our kids who had previously been left behind, to use that phraseology. Reforming education was a major focus of his 2000 campaign. He went beyond the usual Republican orthodoxy of calling for the abolishment of the Department of Education. A lot of you remember that orthodoxy. And he knew that we could spur change, especially for our neediest students. You may remember him talking about the soft bigotry of low expectations. Too many poor and minority kids were simply shuffled through the system year after year without getting the skills that they needed, literally off to a lifetime of underperformance, underachievement, and often failure. The president's vision of education, his willingness to make it a top priority, helped to close the gap politically, the political gap, with Democrats on the issue. And that, I need not remind you Floridians, was a pretty razor-thin margin. It was important that he talked about education. So No Child Left Behind became law about 8 years ago this month. Literally, well, is this the eighth? This is the eighth birthday of No Child Left Behind this very day. And it brought about serious and fundamental changes to the way we think about education. And it, first and foremost, demanded results. We did this with amazing bipartisan majorities that, as we look at the Congress now, are really unthinkable. This law passed the U.S. Senate by 87 to 10 and similar margins in the House with the support of Republicans and Democrats alike. It said that if we invest resources, we ought to get something for it. Number one, it asked states to set standards, to tell teachers what it is those kids need to be able to know and do. No more excuses. We did away with the mindset that some kids, especially from poor minority families, just weren't equipped to learn and it was okay to just move them through the system. Every child, as we know, can learn and deserves to learn, and frankly, the future of our country depends on it. Number two, we asked states to test those students, each and every student, one time a year. Now, I know we're going to get the questions, we're going to get a lot of teaching to the test and too much testing and all that stuff. Glad to answer it. But we ask states to test kids once a year to find out how they're doing, where they're falling short, where we need to intervene, what their teachers' capabilities are, and so forth. And number three, we ask schools to be accountable. If a school's failing, we need to focus on the students getting what they need to succeed. That's why we made money available for tutoring and school choice. And we made it clear that if schools fail to improve year after year, that something had to happen. These three ideas, standards, assessments, and accountability, were essential to meeting this goal of having every child on grade level by the end of third grade. Because if we don't meet that goal, we're in a world of hurt. As you know, And I see that there's lots of interest here, Karen, all these people walking around with their questions, like you said. Anybody who's paying attention the last 8 years knows that No Child Left Behind has been absolutely controversial, and people know about this law. If you walked out here and asked people, have you ever heard of No Child Left Behind, they would say yes. And that tells me that this law has some power. It's working. It's doing some things. Much of the controversy, of course, was generated by interest groups who wanted the status quo, who liked it the way it was. And some of the fiercest opposition, of course, came from the teachers' unions. I'm careful to say teachers' unions and not teachers, because good teachers that I've met all over the country and all over the world, frankly, don't fear accountability. They want more than anybody for their students to be successful. That's why they're in this business. But the unions are sometimes a different story. To them, charter schools are not good. Efforts to link teacher pay to performance in the classroom are bad. Measures that require schools to show effectiveness are not good. And consequences for failure are not in order. So the employee groups and some other allies, often vested interests, threw the book at No Child Left Behind. Literally, it's been blamed for everything from obesity to head lice. I kid you not. We'll get to the head lice if you want. But a lot of parents, especially minority parents, know the truth. They know that their kids have been shuffled through the system, and they see past the rhetoric. Despite efforts to divide suburban communities from urban communities, I have never met a parent who didn't want their child to be successful, who didn't want their child to get a good education. And we're making progress. What gets measured does indeed get done. Since No Child Left Behind passed, more kids are proficient in math and reading. The achievement gap is closing, and achievement is up across the board. It's up in places like Florida. And more kids have school choice, tutoring, intervention, the sorts of things they need to get help and get caught up. Much of the progress has been in our elementary schools and middle schools, because that is the focus of No Child Left Behind. But in high school, there's still lots to do. Half the inner city students who start high school never finish. Okay, think about that. Half the Hispanic and African American kids in this country fail to finish high school on time. Now, if you're from Texas or Florida, you ought to be worried about that. Our country suffers from lost talent, lost potential, lost opportunity, let alone the consequences for those individuals. So we need to bring higher standards, assessments, accountability to our high schools as well, especially with a focus on reducing the dropout rate. Despite the carping about No Child Left Behind, it has absolutely redefined the way we think about education. For a long time, we talked about inputs, about class size, about all, you name it, everything in the world, but we never really talked about how the kids were doing. No Child Left Behind has changed that. Any serious discussion includes a focus on student achievement. And I'm really glad that the current administration is focused on many of these same ideas as well. Despite our differences, I'm really pulling for them, because education really is not something that divides Republican and Democrat. We all believe it is the key to our future. It's really interesting to me to hear voices and people like Newt Gingrich, who I know has come to address you, and Al Sharpton, and my successor Arnie Duncan, who were on Meet the Press a couple of months ago, in violent agreement about all of the things that we're talking about: greater accountability, greater focus on the achievement gap and the dropout rate. But I'm not going to get overly excited yet, because as we Texans say, I've been to this rodeo before. A lot of the same people who were fighting all these years against No Child Left Behind now want to lead a race to the top, as if the standards were not high enough, that's why we couldn't bring up the bottom. I've been in the line of fire from the unions and the old guard in education who don't want to change. And I know from experience that there will be a lot of pressure on Secretary Duncan to grant waivers, to go back to business as usual. So we need to pay attention. We need to urge our policymakers to pay attention, and we need them to stay strong on reform. You're lucky here in Florida because you're on the right track. Former Governor Jeb Bush saw the success of what another Governor Bush was doing and other leaders around the country, and he brought a lot of those ideas to Florida, and he improved upon them. Florida has been a real model in a lot of these areas, in pay for performance, in charter schools, in school choice, and on and on and on. And we have to get more serious, not only at the state level, but also as a country. We need to ask ourselves some really tough questions that are often uncomfortable. Do we really, truly believe that every child, or virtually every child, can learn to some sort of standard, to high standards? And are we willing to do what it takes to give them the support to cause that to occur? Do we think it's okay, that it's acceptable, that half the Black and Hispanic students in this country fail to graduate from high school on time? Is that okay with us? It's staggering, but that number hadn't changed much in a pretty long time. Are we going to demand that our schools succeed? Are we willing to shake things up if they don't? Will we challenge old ideas like the same amount of time for every kid and the same number of school days that we've had for so many years? Does it make sense to send our least experienced teachers to the toughest schools while we send our most experienced teachers to the least challenging educational settings often? Do we believe that teachers and administrators ought to be held accountable for classroom performance? These are the things we should ask ourselves, and these are the questions we need to ask our elected leaders. Unless we're willing to work at every level to make serious changes in education, we're going to watch more and more students get pushed through the system and come out the other end knowing very little. And when we talk about preparing people for the future, we need to talk about higher education as well. In today's knowledge economy, higher education has really gone from a nice to have to a must have. We've always been pretty good in this country at educating elites, but we need to be much better about educating many, many more people. The ticket to a good job and a salary that can support a family is often linked to higher education. As a nation, higher education drives our growth, drives innovation, and our economy forward. When I was the Secretary of Education, I put together a commission to study American higher education. And it reported back that our college and universities obviously are the finest in the world. We're proud of that. They have many strengths. But they also have some troubling challenges. Namely, too few people are graduating from college. It's too expensive and gotten much more so over the last decade or so. And it's largely unaccountable to students, parents, and taxpayers. And we are very significant investors as taxpayers in American higher education. Think about this. By age 29, over a third of white Americans will have a bachelor's degree. For black Americans, the rate is about 17%. For Hispanics, it's 11%. About a 1 in 10 chance of getting a college degree. Think about that if you're from Florida or Texas. We need to fix this. And we need to start, as I said, by redoubling our efforts to fix K-12 education. Until we get that right, our kids are going to show up in higher education unprepared to be successful there. And we also have to address the issue of cost. Both tuition and levels of student debt have exploded. To make college more affordable, we need to provide more need-based aid, and we need to help our low-income and middle-income students access higher education. The third challenge is accountability. Are colleges and universities giving students what they want and need? Are they giving them good value for their money? Too many schools are stuck in the same mold that's been in place for the last 100 years. Academic calendars that are rigid, classes that are in person and in limited time from 10 to 2 on weekdays, degrees that are awarded after so much time spent on a campus. They're often not meeting the needs of today's students, more and more of whom are working professionals, single moms and dads trying to give their careers a boost. A lot of people who are on the long-term plan going back to school after 10 to 20 years in the marketplace. And they care deeply about how their tuition dollars and how their days are spent. Colleges need to respond to these trends with more flexibility in scheduling, more rigorous online courses to make education more accessible to busy adults, and with more career-oriented options for people trying to get a leg up in their professions. We're seeing some changes from the traditional model, and it's interesting that a lot of it is being driven by for-profit institutions. Government policymakers generally don't like for-profit education because they think that it doesn't really serve the needs of students all that well. But in reality, many for-profit higher ed companies all over the world are doing what for-profit companies do, understand their customers and respond to them. It's crucial that we get this right because our competitors around the world are investing heavily in higher education. In India and China, more and more students are being educated to higher levels than our students. We know we are not going to outcompete with these economies on the price of labor. We have to compete on education and innovation. Every country knows this, and that's why they're investing with the anticipation for long-term returns. And we must do more to stay on top. At every level of education, from pre-K to college, we need to get serious about making schools better. Better schools for the sake of students who deserve the best start, and better schools for the sake of our country, which needs highly educated, motivated individuals to keep our country moving forward. Years of research and data tells us that schools are better when we focus on high standards, accountability, and incorporate meaningful measurement. I've been honored to work with outstanding people who are committed to these ideas. But after all the progress we've made, I'd hate to see us let the boulder roll down the hill. And I want to ask you to join me in urging our policymakers to continue to stay vigilant on reform. I appreciate your time today. I hope I've given you some sense of education policy. You can tell I'm very passionate about it, and I'm not getting off the stage of pounding my fist about these ideas anytime soon. Thanks for being a great audience, and I'd be delighted to answer your questions.
Thank you.
Ray, thank
Good
you.
Job.
Thank you.
Margaret, that was a great speech, and we very much appreciate it. We've got a couple of gifts for you to show our appreciation. One is a picture book of Naples.
Oh, great.
And another is a culture and history of Marco Island.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you very
I'll
much.
Hold on to these for
okay,
you.
Okay, thank you, thank you.
Here we go.
Thanks.
And Karna has some questions.
Okay, Karna. So I'm going to stand over here.
Yep, we do.
First question for you is from one of our students who maybe didn't get what you were talking about earlier. What kind of test are you talking about once a year?